from changing a few words, actually went on to say that violent action against the university caused in part by the university's refusal to be responsive to students. I was sorely tempted at the time to read to deans, you say, when I was changing it, but I chose not to do that because I concluded that I had not thrown that bottle through that window in my capacity as dean. I was definitely acting as advisor to Seal, and I would like to think I was acting as me, not a nice guy, not a dean, okay, not a guy who wears a bow tie, but me, and that's something a little bit bigger than labels, and labels have a lot to do with the story thing. Anyway, I said to the cop, I'm an assistant dean of student personnel. I said, in the course of a lecture demonstration a few moments ago at the Daily Illini, I broke a window. I said, now, if you hear a report of a broken window at the Daily Illini, that's my window, and I'll be happy to pay for it. And the little man at the other end said, yes, sir, and hung up. Now, I started out of the phone booth, and then something bothered me, and I called Huntley, and I called the Daily Illini, and I figured, oh, God, they all know my name. What are they going to do? I mean, they know my voice. So what are they going to do? But they did put me through to Huntley, and I said, now, look, John. I said, I'm just going to make a factual input here. I'm not discussing it. I'm just going to make a factual input. I said, it is true that when you saw me outside of the union, I was highly agitated. I want to make it very clear that I was agitated not because I was angry at the Daily Illini, but because I knew I was going to break your window. All right, because I felt that was important, all right? He said, I've got it. He said, it was a beautiful bit of guerrilla theater, a label. And then we both hung up. And I stood there and said, damn. Well, I went to my office, and I called up George Fredericks, who isn't here, which is too bad. I says, George, you will not believe this story. So I told him everything I just told you, and we laughed until I thought we would die. We laughed and laughed and laughed, and then we said, now what are they going to do? What are they going to do? Because we have mapped back onto them all the behavior that they claim the administration and the Board of Higher Education, everybody else exhibits, and then we have behaved toward them the way they see students behaving toward the higher board and so on and so forth. And what are they going to do with it? I said, for example, do you think they'll report it? Are they going to print my letter? We both concluded they would not. I said, are they even going to mention that this happened? We decided that they had only two ways out. They could write an article something like the following. Dean Eisenman, label, in an effort to show our editorial policy incorrect, staged an act of guerrilla theater at the Daily Illini. This would be a typical newspaper route out. You do not deal at all with any of the dilemmas raised, any of the issues. You simply just state the bare bones of the fact so that we're all able to dismiss it, you see, just like that. There is another possibility, and that is utter silence, and that is what we have got, ladies and gentlemen. I met Hundley the next morning, and I said, John, I'm amused to see what you have indeed finally printed as a letters page. The first, if you waste 3 inches on a woman who castigates your coverage of the school board election. She just calls you boob for 3 inches. And I wouldn't say that instructed anybody very much. Then you have a couple letters that really do bear on the school board election. And then you have a 6-inch letter which agrees with you that indeed the seal thing shows us that nice guys do finish last. And then you have a 12-inch article by John Ronsville, turned in a half hour after I turned mine in, because I saw him turn it in, which agrees with your second editorial, which is that since we keep getting screwed and the channels, all we've got left is violence. I said, so you printed 2 inches longer than my letter of letters that were supporting the two editorials that I was trying to provide a counterfoil to. And I said, and of course you didn't print anything about the fact that I threw a brick through your window. He says, that's right. He said, you're the only one talking about it. We've instructed our staff not to say a word about it, he said. Well, I think that's about it, except for one further thing, which is that a week went by and I was out of town, and then they did print my letter on Tuesday. In fact, maybe that's an important factual input. The letter, I'm not going to read it to you because some of you saw it. It doesn't matter if you did. What it says, in effect, corrects the error about where Seal stands. It makes this point. The DI has not grasped, even on the day of Carswell's rejection, that all is not lost with the first round. I think it was a point worth making. And then I said, you know, that Seal's assumption all along had been that the way you treat a bureaucracy, if you want to send a new message in, is not to make the mistake of thinking that there is such a thing as a channel, which anybody's mental image is of walls, and you launch something in it, and if you start it all right at this end, it comes out the other end. It doesn't work that way. Anytime you want to do something, it requires a whole different mess of people. So I said that kind of stuff, and said that our fundamental operating principle in SEAL was, don't rely on any bureaucrat to do anything for you. You must go to every office that will ever be involved in carrying out what it is you want done, and you must convince them to do it. That's part of the way the world works. And I ended up by saying that I thought that it wasn't very useful when you lose to go looking around for evil. What you learn early is that a bureaucracy is more than Chancellor Jack. It's the little lady buried in the bowels of the administration building and the harried $10,000-a-year accountant and God knows who all. Getting them connected up and working together on your plan is a non-trivial activity. It is hardly accurate to describe the failure as a triumph of evil over good. I went on to say, it is maddening not to be able to get a little, simple, obvious thing done today. But I don't find religious ceremonies conducted by loco parentes a very appropriate response in this age. Perhaps that's because I am a physicist and happen to know that besides rain dances, you can try seeding the clouds. You don't always win. For one thing, you don't always have a cloud. But it's worth trying. And I think it's far superior to escalating rain dances into human sacrifices, even if they are more fun and easier than messing with the clouds. Well, they printed it, you see, on Tuesday. On Thursday, I was back in town, and I took John Hundley and Carl Schwartz to lunch, and we talked about other things that we did have to talk about, projects I'm working on that I know they would be interested in. And at the end, I said, look, I kind of think I'd like to give a public presentation of this little event because it is, in some sense, a nice case study in violence and the way it relates into issues. And how would you like to be on the panel? Would you do it? I said, I don't want it to be me versus you. I just want to go into this thing. And I got a sort of a semi-agreement out of Hundley. He's a little nervous about it, but he agreed. He agreed that the whole thing, he could not defend what his bureaucracy had done. He said they should have done better. I said, no, you shouldn't have. You did exactly what one would expect of any bureaucracy. I don't find it at all surprising, nor do I think that there's anything you could do to stop it from happening the next time. It always works this way. But he thought he might. Well, on Friday, I called him up and he said he wouldn't be on the panel, that he decided against it. And then I spoke to Roger Simon. Now, if you know Roger Simon, you know that all year he's been making remarks about Campus Jack and about, what does he call him? Union Jack. And the Chancellor's had a regular feud going on, and he has attributed to the Chancellor a good deal of the behavior that I claim, you see, was exhibited by the Daily Illini. And he's had very more sinister explanations for it than I claim I have. Well, anyway, I went to Roger and I said to him, will you be on this panel? And he said, no. And I said, well, can you give me some reason why not? And he said, look, I just don't want to discuss it. I'm not going to be on this panel. I said, okay, but I'm forced to point out to you the parallel. I mean, here you are refusing, you see, to come and speak with us. There's one other thing I might point out in the way of parallels. The little girl who was running the editorial, I started worrying about her at 1 a.m. This all happened around 11:30. At 1, it occurred to me I might have upset her. And I did not mean to upset her. I didn't want to upset her, and I was not angry at her in any way. And I worried a little bit about it. And so I asked Hundley on Friday, the day after this all happened, was she upset? And he said, yes, she was. He said, it's part of the business, though, you know. I said, she cried, I guess. I said, I feel bad about that, but, you know, I'm forced to think that when I told her myself that I hadn't anything against her, and when I told you all that again 5 minutes after I did that thing, and she still got upset, I suggest to you that repeating day after day that the Chancellor's escapades cost him $20,000 worth of broken glass might be expected to do something to the Chancellor. It might not be the kindest human act, besides being fact-accurate and a lousy causal explanation. It just might even be a little bit inhuman. Well, anyway, let's flash forward a week again. Here I am talking to Roger Simon. So I said, there you are, Roger. I think I see another parallel. He says, you've been pushing this thing too far. You have from the start. I said, Roger, that's something you said the very night it all happened. You said, Eisenman, you're drawing too great an analogy between what's going on here and what you claim we talk about all the time. Is that your reason for not appearing on this panel? And he said, well, no. And I said, so there's more. I said, I feel there's more to it than that. And I said, now, Roger, you're not smiling. This isn't your usual cheerful self. Why aren't you here? You know, I mean, you're usually a pretty sporting fellow. And I admit, you know, it's a dangerous game, but I'm surprised you're not playing. And he said, well, frankly, my reasons are personal, and I'm not going to tell them to you, and I certainly wouldn't tell them to any audience. Well, if I have shaken up someone's worldview, that, in some sense, is a dangerous act. Incidentally, I've shaken up my own. I am much more aware of how close we all are to violence, and incidentally, how labeling things has something to do with it. I was reading My Lie yesterday. Apparently, you can shoot a two-month-old baby if you can think that it's a VC. And if you can associate the VC with your buddy who got blown up yesterday by a mine. And I think that this process of labeling, dehumanizing, is a process which is extraordinarily important in our society, and that maybe justifies my boring you here this afternoon. Well, I'm done. I would like you to ask me any questions you'd like about how I felt at any time before, during, or after, about what you think about the Daily Line, or anything you want to pick on. Now, Bob, maybe you can put this together here. Come on.
I'd like to ask a question, and I gather that the gist of what you're trying to say is that bureaucracies are ponderous machines, and that the reasons they don't work sometimes lies in the machinery and not in the people who try to drive it, and that violence is a meaningless act in trying to fix the machine. It's like taking a hammer and your car doesn't work, so you take a sledgehammer and you slam the car with it because you're angry at it. And yet, look what has happened. I mean, going back to what this guy Simon said to you, first of all, you felt real good about throwing the bottle, but we won't go into the reasons why you felt good about it. Those are your own. So the act itself had something productive, at least for you. I mean, that's the way I read it. You look good, and it felt good. And second of all, besides the way it affected you, look what it has led to. It has led to, I don't know, there are about, I don't know, 70, 50 people in this audience who are listening with rapt interest to what you have to say.
Let them speak for themselves.
Well, I was fascinated in it, and it would seem to me if you had circulated a brochure saying, I have a disagreement with the Daily Illini, come and hear it, no one would have come. Perhaps some of your friends would have come, and there would have been three people in the audience. When you said, I threw a bottle in through the window, all of a sudden, you shed light on your anger and on the whole issue. So in that sense, one could argue that an act of violence was productive in first in the way it affected you, and second, in the sense of advertising one of the problems with the bureaucracy of the Daily Illini.
What can I say? I wanted the letter. That's all right. So it wasn't productive of the thing I wanted to get. Well, all right, let's talk about that. The people who burned down their houses in Watts, okay, I suppose got something. Is that right? That was violence that led to something? Well, was it? For one thing, it's a rather plausible act of violence. It's your own house. I might say that impresses me more than breaking someone else's window. Okay. And one of the things I pointed out to Roger Simon was how really false this whole thing was. I said, for one thing, instead, you saw me throw it through the window, and I told you why I did it. Now, when's the last time you saw somebody break a window and stand there and give you a little lecture as to why he did it? I said, I have given you, if anything, the greatest opportunity to make a cause-effect relationship between my violence and that broken window, and you're going to have an even harder time than doing it, because A, I'm overworked, and it is true I'm under a lot of nervous strain. B, I was mad at the Daily Illini. C, I didn't like to be labeled a nice guy, and in some sense wanted to show you I wasn't. But D, I wanted to show you violence wouldn't produce a result, okay, even when you could convince the other side by getting their attention through violence that the result needed to be produced. So I wanted you to show you that lesson. I once wrote down some 15 different reasons that we could give why I threw the bottle through the window of the Daily Illini, and I call them all to Roger Simon's attention and say, how can you single one out and say that's why he threw the bottle through the window of the Daily Illini? But that's getting into a digression. Was it a productive thing? Really had a higher chance, right.
Thank you.
there was good that came of it.
Isn't it absurd? Yeah. Not just to get a change now, but to get people to think about the permanent change.
Did everyone hear that? You all hear that? Well, I want to respond to that. In the first place, for some funny reason, it never occurred to me to pull rank. That is to say, when I went in there, I asked somebody, like Roger, who is running the letters page today, and I went and spoke to that girl, and it never occurred to me, I guess I did, actually, I went to Marcia Kramer, and I said to Marcia, tell this girl to behave decently toward me. I think that was the way I put it. And Marcia said, screw him, she said, you know. So there was a little acting play game, but, you know, it never really occurred to me to push the battle at 4:30. For one thing, I didn't know I'd lost it yet. And by 10:30, it was true, everything was in type. And so in some sense, I want to just make clear that I wasn't entrapping. In other words, it wasn't my conscious plan on my mind at 4:30 in the afternoon to set up a way that the Daily Atlanta would fail and then go ahead and show them how they'd fail. That never even occurred to me. I didn't know it was going to fail until 10:30 when it did fail. Now, the second point is that maybe they will do better in the future because I've broken their window and called to them this particular problem with their procedure. Well, I have this to say to that. That girl was being letters editor that night, and some other girl or guy will be letters editor some other night, some other year. And there is no way that I know of to build a rule book, a mechanical map for a bureaucracy that will somehow or other turn people into perfectly operating automatons. And in fact, I'm going to object to your comment about what I think about bureaucracies. I do not think that they are machines. I think they're quite the opposite. They're complex nerve nets, okay, you know, a neural net like your brain, lots of nerves connecting into lots of other nerves. And nerves get old and die, and sometimes they're injured, and sometimes they're just bad nerves. And there are lots of reasons why you do not have interchangeable parts in bureaucracies the way you do in a machine. That if you take one guy and put him in a certain title, he'll be the same as the last guy. That's far from the truth. And to learn to make a bureaucracy work means learning about individual people, and about how you rub them wrong and how you rub them right, and how they talk to each other, and which people they can get along with and which ones they can't. And it's a human enterprise, not a mechanical enterprise. I resist mechanical analogies. And I don't think that you can write down forever a cure to these things. And I have a depressing message for you, which is if you want to deal with a bureaucracy, you must spend a lot of time learning to know the people in that bureaucracy. And when you know them, you may be able to get them to see that the thing that you have to do is worth their doing, even though they already have a full day's worth of things to do, which they all do by one of Parkinson's laws. Question in the middle somewhere. Yes?
Well, related to the point you made about the lack of interchangeability of Parkinson's.
Yes.
I'd like to point out that within the bureaucracy, you
can
also have
conflicting factions. Oh, sure. Quite right.
A beautiful example of this is the way the irate people in the Illinois Assembly cut the appropriations to the University of Illinois because of the violence done.
Well, now you see, there you are with a causal inference that I'm not ready to accept. They had a lot of reasons for cutting the university's budget, and one of their excuses was the violence done. I do think that people who do violence have to worry about that kind of thing. That's called accountability. Yes. And Ellen, this bears on your point too. Let's grant you your point and say that I do cause a change in the Daily Atlanta. Do you think the next change could be caused in the same way by another person throwing a bottle through the same window? Or don't you think that after one or two bottles, people would begin paying less attention to the act? I mean, it gets less plausible every time you use it. There's a certain surprise value involved in the first act of violence. It's not there in the second. Well, I think, you know, you're right that they still haven't gotten the point because yesterday or a couple of days ago, they have another editorial this one by Carl Schwartz, and it has to do with a conversation I had with Carl Schwartz, and it says, I was reminded by a friend of mine at lunch yesterday, I guess that shows I'm still not a friend, you know, that people really ought to be more patient, he says. After all, he said, good Lord, when this entire country united everything it had and everything it could produce, it still took us 4 years to defeat that horrible menace Adolf Hitler. I did make that remark. He then said, the inference being, of course, and this is not the inference, that maybe we should not all be upset that it may take more than 4 years to put an end to an unjust and imperialist motivated war in Vietnam, say at least 9 years already, or to put an end to racism in the United States, say at least 352 years, or to put an end to man's civil war with the environment, say maybe 2 million years. That was not what I was saying. I was simply saying that as badly as a thing needs to be done, it may not always be possible to do it on the time scale that you set up in your mind. That one ought to see the difference between one's conception of the world and the real world. And to constantly pretend as if the real world were an incipient utopia, just waiting for your wisdom, is, I think, to really ignore the actual facts of the matter. My point about Hitler was only that we had reached that unusual stage where everyone in the country pretty well did agree that there was something that we had to do collectively. And we have not reached that stage. I'm not saying that we should be happy about the fact that we haven't reached that stage, but we haven't, as a matter of fact, reached that stage on either the race relations in this country or on the war. And I don't think anyone should be too surprised then that we're not making a great deal of progress in getting them settled. What we have to do is convince people that those things need to be done. But even when everyone was convinced with the Hitler thing, technically it may take a little while. That was my point. And he still hasn't gotten it. You see, he thinks I'm telling everyone, go home, be calm, don't worry about these things. I'm not saying that. I'm saying I'm as tied up with knots in my stomach as the next guy over Vietnam. It makes me physically ill to read about my lie. But I know also that there's nothing I can do about it. And sometimes that's the toughest thing for a person to face, is that the battle he wants to fight is not the one he can fight, and he better find another one nearer to him that's worth fighting, if not the best of all possible battles. Can you speak louder? I think no one can hear you in the back.
I think the violence is loose in the community, say, in North Africa last fall. People use it against themselves, and they risk their own causes, say, in terms of cooperation. And I think violence has more than a perpetrator as well. It's supposed to be institutions against each other, correct? Say, for instance, in the North Africa, the grocery store, that was supposed to be helpful, or something depressing. And I think the violence against bullets,
does anybody wish to speak to the opposite side? This gentleman has just said that acts of violence usually tell more about the people who perpetrate them than they do about the institutions which they claim to be aiming their violence at. I stand guilty of that, I guess. I don't know. Do you know more about me than you knew before? You know I'm not a nice guy, or do you? You see, the thing I found amusing was that after I thought about it, I said it's fascinating that I did say to the policeman that this was in the course of a lecture demonstration, because you see, that was my rationalization. The fellow who throws the brick through Fowlett's window may have a girlfriend angry at him, may have a mother who doesn't like him. Well,
maybe the only formula in which you could commit an act of violence. It's the first time you ever committed an act of violence. The only formula you could find for doing it was to make a point against violence.
Yeah, I'm reminded of that. Of that dilemma that they give you as a school child, and they say, if the devil came to you and said, if you just commit this one sin, I'll save everyone else, including you, are you justified in committing that sin? And the answer, of course, although you know, you really thought that was a good deal. You said you're in second grade, boy, what a deal, a little sin, you get everybody off, you know, everybody goes to heaven. And you say, sure, I do that. And they say sternly, no, they say, it is never justified. Well, I guess I have to say that I had the liberating experience of breaking glass, and I can point it out. Ernest, you can go home and throw a bottle through your window, and it's a violent act in some sense, but you pay for your own window, and I can't really see that it's criminal in any way. I'm willing to pay, and I even told the police I would pay for the daily line window. In fact, maybe the very best thing we could do is just have a spring thing around here where we get Bacon and Van Busker to give us all their defective glass and set it up somewhere and send people in. And maybe we could even have cops that they're supposed to sneak by, and then they can throw their bottles, and if they get through, they get their money back, and if the cop catches them, they end up paying. But my point is that I'm willing to pay for my window. So, I had it both ways, but you can too, and anyone can. Break your own window, not Follett's.
That's not fair.
Well, all right, I hear you are, Ernest. I'm reminded of what Albert Einstein said when they told him that Kaufmann, the best experimentalist in Germany, had done an experiment which disproved his special relativity theory. And he turned to them and he said, and Kaufmann had never been known to fail, you know, and he turned to them and said, "It's right. My theory's right." I'm not worried about your hypothetical. Has it? I don't know. I was a nervous wreck for 3 days. I couldn't eat.
You're here. You're telling us the whole circumstance, but the act was directed against, not personally against the DI, but what have they done, for example, to, have they really reacted to this, or have they, in fact, is the act of silence, sheer silence, an act of ignoring?
I don't know. I wish they were here to talk about that. I would like to think that a point had been made. I don't know what point, incidentally. I'm not just sure how they've put the thing together. But that something, this experiment, what I have given them in some sense is a controlled laboratory experiment where for a change, they have all the information that they want, in fact, more than they want. Okay, they had a theory about violence and the way it operates on this campus and the causal relationships between people's behavior, like administrative behavior, and people's violence. They had a theory. I have now provided them with a laboratory experiment under very controlled conditions that they can compare to their theory. And if they have found their theory wanting, maybe that they're down there in a busy process of reassessing the world.
But their theory. Non-presence here forces me to assume an awful lot of things about their reaction to the act. And
yeah.
They're also whether they are reflecting.
Yeah, I find it regrettable. I said to them over and over again, I don't intend this to be a feud between the Daily Alina and David Eisman. I'm not interested personally in making a hero out of myself, because I'm not. It was a silly little thing, and it will fade away. But there was a marvelous mapping back onto the situation of the comments that each of us were making about situations like this. You wrote editorials about things like this. I wrote a response about things like this. And then this thing happened to us. And it's such a lovely symmetrical parallel that it had to be completed by my throwing the bottle through the window, okay? And now we've got it all wrapped up, a mapping of a problem back onto itself. And they've got to assess it. They've got to untangle it somehow. Now, there are a lot of ways you can do this. I pointed out one. You can just dismiss it, as Roger Simon claims to be doing, by saying, Eisenman, you're pushing this parallel too far, and then not discussing it any further. But the very fact that his hand twitches and that he can't smile suggests to me that that isn't all that's happening to Roger Simon right at the moment. Now, I don't know what is happening to him. Maybe he's just broken up with his girl and it has nothing to do with my breaking his window. I don't know. I wish I did. That's why there's a chair for him right over there. I'm hung up, too. I don't know. I don't think so, no. I've discharged my obligation. There's a tape recorder running over there. It's on tape. I only got it down because, in some sense, I thought it was a nice little bit of guerrilla theater, if you want to put a label on it. I discovered guerrilla theater that night. I'm kind of happy about that. I leave little monuments behind me in my life about things that happened that I enjoyed. So it's done.
Dave, I was struck by the fact that before you came out here, you wanted to read the article on My Lai, and that you had read it. How does that fit in? What is that act of violence like, the business of the child being killed, and your act of violence or the act of violence of radicals? And what are the parallels? And how do these things fit?
I think they do fit. Remember, it's as an American as apple pie to say the only good Indian is a dead Indian. When we were on the frontier, you came up against the necessity of staying alive. You weren't an anthropologist. You didn't understand the Indian. And so the only way you could cope with him was to eradicate him. And the way that was done was that we, A, called him evil. We called him a savage. So we personified his behavior as being evil. And then we depersonified him and made him subhuman by calling him a savage. And then we said the only good Indian is a dead Indian. Now, in some sense, that goes on all the time. In Vietnam, things are very tense. Your buddy is blown up by a mine. It is a senseless act. It makes no sense. And it gets you directly in the gut, and it's beyond your control. And you start looking for someone, even though this is, we all know, Vietnam is a mess. It's caused by 1,000 things of international diplomacy and the way the rice grows and God knows what else. But you are looking for someone who busted up your buddy. So what you do is you say, it's the VC. And they're evil. They're commies. You start putting labels on them, and labels allow you to stop looking at men, you know, who are born, who grow, who eat, who love, who die. You stop looking at them as men, and you label them. They're VC. That's different from human. That's different from Joe here, who has a name, who is a guy, you know, to whom I talk. He's just a VC. And that can be carried so far that in the case of the My Lai massacre, I commend to you the